Hey, everybody, it's Scott. Welcome back to another episode of the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. We got a great one today. We are going to Hawaii. Okay, but first let's talk a little bit about some of the sponsors we have on this cast. And one of them happens to be Demented Brewing, located in Middlesex, New Jersey. One of my favorite breweries to visit. One of the coolest tap rooms around. 16 different tap handles. Something new every Sunday. Something in the ton every Tuesday. Bottle programs, sour programs. This Friday, today, they're going to be releasing Grim Reaper, their black IPA brewed with Carolina Reaper peppers. On draft in the tasting room. So it's one of my favorite places to go grab a beer. So make sure to go check it out. That is Demented Brewing, located in Middlesex, New Jersey. Now, Manskirt Brewing. Manskirt Brewing is another awesome craft brewery located in Hackettstown, New Jersey. A really wide open, nice space in the old bank building on Main Street. Manskirt is definitely one that you need to go visit. They're planning a big Cinco de Mayo event to celebrate a new beer release that is top secret, but they did just can their Penny Top Amber Ale, which is delicious, so go pick up some cans of that. Go support Manskirt Brewing, Manskirt Brewing on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Now, Wolf Nation, that stands for Wake Up, Live Free Apparel, the world's next hottest and biggest designer brand. No matter what your goals are in life, as long as you are pursuing it, Wolf Nation is the brand for you. Make sure to go follow them on Instagram where they're taking pre-orders. So if you DM them at Wolf Nation or email them at wolf@wolfnation, they're taking pre-orders on all sorts of things. They got new wolfwear for both men, women, hats, bags, mugs, and it's really starting to take off. So you got to go check them out. That is Wolf Nation. Check out their website at wolfnation.rocks. Wake up, live free. Susan Robb is a woman out of Toronto, Canada, who helps our show out. She works with senior executives in leadership development, also runs a business as a speaker agent, and has gotten us some pretty cool guests. Her and a gal named Kim Ward from Wisconsin, they are putting together a program. They're tirelessly advocating and raising money to inspire and empower a group of women and kids from Nepal. And what they're trying to do is put 14 kids through school and also help these ladies make a sustainable sewing business where they sell these beautiful quilts that you got to go check out. They've already sold 13 of these in 4 different countries. So you're really helping a good cause, the Nepal Outreach Program. So go to their GoFundMe. GoFundMe/Vimla, V-I-M-L-A. Finally, Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Each week, we host trivia in different beer bars and breweries all over New Jersey. Come on out and win some prizes, free to play. It's just a lot of fun. So check it out, Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. All right, like I said, we went to Hawaii today. We have two awesome guests from Hawaii. The first one, surfing legend, windsurfer, stand-up paddleboarder, has been around surfing basically for decades at this point. Very influential in the surfing community. Did a TED Talk recently. That is Dave Kalama. Really cool guest. Now, some of the audio is a little rough because of the connection we were doing in the car, so I kind of pieced it together the best we could, but a really cool interview. And then we have a man by the name of Terry Kirby, and he works for the Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory, or HURL, and he tells us all about the submarines and some of the things they are doing. So just a really set of interviews, and we also get some insight into Hawaiian pizza. So, with that, guys, enjoy the podcast.
Hey, this is Dave Kalama. You're listening to Verbal Shenanigans, so stick around because there's a lot more good stuff coming up.
This is Terry Kirby. I'm the operations director and chief pilot with the University of Hawaii's Hawaii Undersea Research Lab. You are listening to Verbal Undersea Research Lab.
But our shenanigans are cheeky.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Everybody, welcome to your weekly edition of the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. It's great to be back, as always. Just a busy week. I hope you tuned in last week to check out the one and only Andrew WK. Just a mysterious, really cool opportunity to interview him. So that was really fun. And then we also had Peter Giljamon, who was a an animal trainer, works in zoos all over the world. Just a really cool episode last week. So make sure you check that out. I just want to say, guys, we are brought to you by the BS Podcast Network. So go check them out. They got a lot of good shows on there, including us, most importantly us. But it's really good to be back, guys. So let's get Berlew on the line here. I got to, call him now because he's no longer here, which is somewhat depressing. But let's give him a call and see if this works on the first try. Nothing ever seems to work on the first try. So let's see. Let's try to give Mikey a call. And let's call. I have his phone number saved as Berlew's Google. It sounds kind of odd to begin with, but let's see if he picks up on the information superhighway. Mike Berlew, please.
Sure.
Oh. Hi, buddy.
What's going on there, Scotty?
Oh, living the dream. One of those, hectic days where I haven't sat down yet. So I have lots prepared for the podcast today is what I'm saying for you.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Let's go with the eighth item.
The eighth item. Eighth item on the list is, what did you do this week? No, I got.
Oh, was that an actual question?
No, I don't know. I have no idea. I'm not with it today. So we're just gonna go with this.
The most prepared podcast on the internet.
That's correct. That's what we've been going by. It hasn't stuck yet. The fans haven't been wearing most prepared podcast shirts yet. But I'm thinking in a few weeks time. It takes some time for things to grow. But anyway,
I figure when you get that tramp stamp tattoo of the phrase, that's when the shirts are going to go rolling off the shelves.
Well, thanks, pal. Way to blow the surprise for everybody.
Well, I mean, it was bound to come out. I mean, I heard Entertainment Tonight was stalking you, looking for a quote about this. So,
yes.
TMZ, all of them.
Ah, that's what the cameras were when I got out of work.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. But did you get to watch WrestleMania, Berlew? I know you're into the wrestling. Did you get to see Ronda Rousey?
I did not pay. I can't remember the last time I paid for a pay per view. I mean, the last time I even saw WrestleMania, I think was probably 4 years ago, something like that.
Ah, I mean, 4 years ago, Andre the Giant versus the Undertaker. That was a classic.
Yeah.
That was classic.
Yeah.
Can't believe the Giant won.
The scalpel match.
The ladder match. Yeah. And then the Andre the Giant did that moonsault off the ladder. That was phenomenal.
Yeah. It was just insane, man. I mean, and then the Iron Sheik came out and he started cursing out and jumping Jim Brunzel for no good reason. It was just freaking nuts.
I am finding it amusing listening to or I guess seeing 30, 40-year-old men upset about how WrestleMania has turned out or they are upset on the storyline wasn't good enough or blah, blah, blah. I do find it quite amusing when I like to see several thousand comics upset about wrestling. So
yeah.
I don't know what that connection is, but I know we talked about it before.
It's weird how these kids are getting doused with chemicals in Syria, but we have to look at the important things like the storyline between Roman Reigns and Brock Lesnar.
Yes. But I know we've talked about it before, but I'm still trying to find deep down what the thread is between comics and wrestling. There has to be some kind of thing and reason why all these comics are diehard wrestling fans. I take the pool of people I know in my life, right? All eight of them. And, I know my one friend is still really into wrestling. The rest of my friends, not. Okay. But that exponentially grows tenfold in the comic community. If I took every comic I knew, I'm thinking it's like 60%, especially among males.
Oh, easily. Yeah, easily. I mean, the only thing I can fathom is most comics are in essence a man child, where they beckon for the attention, and the older days are when they were young, so anything that was great when they were young comes along with them. Cartoons, wrestling, anything like that.
Yeah, it's probably a pretty accurate point, but what did remind me of wrestling was, and maybe I guess we could get into it after, I guess, but our pal Conor McGregor.
He thinks he's in the wrestling ring at all times. He doesn't even know.
That was a straight up Steve Austin in like 1998, like throwing a chair through McMahon's bus or something like that. That was how he is. I mean, he still cracks me up, but he's getting to a point where I don't know if we're ever going to see him fight again because of all this garbage.
Somebody will pick him up. I mean, he'll fight for less at like a Bellator or something like that, but somebody is going to...
The Michael Berlew remix, everybody. Yeah, so Connor is becoming he's becoming like a fictional character at this point. I can't tell what's planned and what's not. I know they say, and I like read all into it and watched all the surveillance videos, and you know, he was defending his boy. They said, "Where's Connor?" But like, is it necessary to fly over 30 Irish goons to break into the Barclays Center and like smash windows of people that aren't even involved in it? I don't know.
And he had a whole plan for this. I mean, he bought tickets from like a third party vendor to get to the event. After they got to the event, they basically found a back door, snuck into the basement, and then went in the basement with all this thought process into it. His first thought is, "Connor smash."
I'm the best in the world. So he lost his belt. But I got to admit,
I can beat you up, boss.
Let's be honest.
You cannot defeat Connor, boss.
We should just do a whole segment. I should go through the shows and just find all
your... I wasn't attempting to do a Connor in that, okay?
Oh, that was just a...
That was just me saying what he would say.
Oh, I thought that was your Connor.
I all the Transformers.
I was waiting for it to turn Russian somehow. Like, I am Connor. But he's, let's be honest. And you see, the belts don't really matter. No one cares who the belts are. It's all about super fights. And, like, people want to see, you know, the purists love the belts and whatnot. But, like, guys get title shots out of nowhere. They had to pull a card together out of nowhere. They lost three fights on that card. And the headliner dropped out. Then Holloway dropped out. And then they had to switch someone. I mean, it was a pretty big disaster for them. But...
yeah, I mean, that's what's going to kill him the most. I mean, I don't think he'll get jail time. Always that, like, first thing they never give jail time for. But he is going to be facing so many lawsuits from fighters, UFC, the venue, I'm sure, will want some money. I'm sure the pay-per-view companies want some money. So,
this one was unnecessary. I mean, although he becomes even more intriguing again, and yeah, it just makes me want to see him fight. I'm interested to see him if they're going to set up Khabib versus Conor in Russia and just have this Rocky IV, Ireland versus Russia, bad guy versus bad guy, kind of like super fight. And it's definitely going to happen. You know how much power Conor has, because even Dana White was asked, like, will you work with him again? And he's like, not right now. Like, I can't see that in the foreseeable future. Uh-huh. It's like, well, if it was a definite no, you would have been like, absolutely not. F this guy. UFC is done with him. Terminated his contract. But there's too many bazillions of dollars sitting on the table.
Yeah, I mean, there's still those, though I don't believe them, the small rumors that Mayweather's going to come over and do a UFC fight for big money. And I mean, it's like you said. I mean, pretty much it's still, as much as everybody says, oh, I love mixed martial arts, blah, 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 it's pretty much only Conor, Ronda Rousey, who probably won't ever come back, and Brock Lesnar. Those are the only three where you're like, oh, my God, I got to see this pay-per-view right now.
Yeah, I mean, you got, like, the next tier of people, like, after that, that, like, the fans know. But, yeah, those are, like, the three that, like, you know, surpass just UFC fans, that the average person knows them. The average guy, the quote-unquote water cooler knows who that is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, those are the three that you go to an Applebee's with a hot dog king, you know?
Yeah. I'm sure that's a reference to everyone but us. Everyone listening gets... Oh, yeah. No, I'm not even going to explain that one. But I think it's time to get to guest number one. We got two guests tonight.
Okay.
I've been wanting to get a surfer on the podcast for quite some time. I've struck out many times. I think I got one email back a long time ago, and it never panned out. But we finally got a surfer, and we got a big one. A man who is apparently kind of created stand-up paddleboarding, surfer, windsurfing. So the guy, if you look up his name is Dave Kalama. If you look him up, his name like pops up with every different type of surfing, and then he's done TED Talks. He's done. So I'm pretty excited. We are going to all Hawaii this cast, Mike.
Oh, I can't wait, man.
All
I
Hawaii. Mean, do you have your coconut bra on?
You know, it's under my shirt, so I'll bring it out later. You know, if the interview's getting a little weird, you know, I'll just, you know, just shoot it out there.
Wait. So if the interview gets weird, then then you break out the coconut bra.
Then I'm going to bring it back in for us, you know. That's how I roll.
You're going to bring it back to normality with a coconut bra. All right.
Exactly. But, I mean, how else would you bring it back to reality?
Okay. So let's give Dave Kalama a call. All right, just want to warn you guys. I just want to give you pre-context here that the audio can be a little rough, so we had to piece it together. Dave was in a car. He dropped out a whole bunch. We got all sorts of, you know, in and out, so we kind of pieced it together. But it was an awesome interview. So here's Dave. Dave, first off, thanks for having given us some time. This is Scott and Mike on Verbal Shenanigans. So, first off, thanks for giving us a few minutes here.
Absolutely.
Now, are you in Hawaii as we speak?
Yep, I'm on the island of Maui.
So today I had someone from Sweden, and now you are in the island of Maui. So we are spreading the globe here. So it is currently like 40 degrees and snowy in New Jersey, so I'm sure you're jealous.
Yeah, my wife's family's from the East Coast. She told me it's snowing out there. I was like, oh, those poor suckers.
Yeah, it's Maui sounds really nice right now. It's been kind of
Hey, you know what? If it makes you feel any better, it's windy and rainy and stormy right now, but it's still in the mid-70s.
Yeah. Stop bragging. You're bragging.
It's our version of a storm.
Yeah. So I'm in the 80s, so I beat all three of you, you know?
Ah, nice.
He's down in Georgia, though, you know. So,
okay.
So he doesn't really count. But, Dave, you look up your name, and you are pretty synonymous with not only just surfing, but... pretty much as I tried to do a little research on you, almost anything that involves a board and water. Did you start off as like a longboarder or just like as a hobby? How did this all start?
Well, if you really want to take it back.
I do.
My father was the 1962 U.S. surfing champion. Wow. So, and I was born in 64. So I got some roots in surfing, and his father was a champion body surfer and canoe paddler, so the roots run pretty deep, which I'm sure had a lot to do with guiding me towards riding boards in the water.
So at a young age, were you like one of those toddlers we see that is able to kind of surf already at a young age, or did you not really develop until later in life?
No, I would say I was a late bloomer. I was not a prodigy surf kid by any means. I grew up surfing on the weekends, of dreaming of being a professional surfer, but by no means pursuing it or competing or anything that would lend you to believe I was on my way. I was just enjoying it because chicks dug it and I wanted to be accepted by my friends.
So when you have a family of that kind of background, were you going out there just like playing around? Is it still fun, or is your family a type that's like, no, you have to do it X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3, and like really pushing every piece of the infrastructure, if you will?
No. When I learned to surf, it was through a cousin that was my age, and it was very much just a playful thing, and I didn't have uncles and aunts and my father looking over our shoulders, guiding us and you know, trying to drive home how important it was that we do it right. We had the freedom away from them to just have fun with it and get into it or not as much as we wanted to.
Now, I want to ask before we go more into your life, how does one become a champion body surfer? Like you said, your grandfather, what is the, like, the, you know, what do you have to do in order? What is a competition like in body surfing?
Well, if you are one of the best body surfers in Hawaii, almost by default, that makes you world class. And so when they would have competitions in Hawaii and he would place on the podium, you could justifiably say, oh, you're one of the world's best now. So while there was not a governing body for body surfers per se, we're just going to go with kind of the law of the land at that time.
Yeah, I'm trying to like picture what the competition in body surfing actually is.
So he grew up at a time when Duke was the main guy.
Right.
And he actually competitively swam against the Duke. Huh. Now, obviously, if he was better than the Duke, you'd probably be talking about my grandfather rather than the Duke. But, you know, still, to compete at that level is something.
Now, Dave, when did you consider, you said, you know, you were a little bit of a late bloomer into, when did you actually consider this as part of, you know, not only a career, but I guess, like, you know, it really has to start to become your whole lifestyle. When did that really start to take place?
You know, it all came about from failure to become a ski racer. I was trying very hard to be a ski racer. I was going to high school up in Mammoth, and so that's what got me going on my ski racing endeavor. And I really tried to be a ski racer, and I had some regional success, but never anything close to national success. And one day I was in this race, and I started out near the bottom of the race, and I got myself up to 12th, and the second run's about, you know, I'm in the starting gate for the second run, and I'm like, okay, this is my moment. I'm going to get my ski racing career back on track. And I blow out on the second gate, and there's no turn at the first gate. And it was as if God said, you know what? You're not meant to be a ski racer. So I skied down, handed my pass to the coach, threw the skis on the car, and never looked back, and was sort of rudderless for a time. And I ended up on Maui on a family vacation, and it spoke to me, literally. And I thought, well, while I'm figuring what's next, I'm going to move to Maui and windsurf and have fun until I figure out where I'm going. And everything fell into place. And the next thing I know, I'm a professional windsurfer. and I can't even believe that this, you know, this is all happening to me.
So tell us a little bit about, you know, getting up to that next level. Like, when I hear stuff about, like, gymnastics and even, like, auto racing, the kids, in order to get professional and compete, have to start when they're, like, 5, 6, 7 years old. As you got into it later, was it easy to just get into the competition, or did it take a lot of learning curves to get there?
Well, you know, that's a great question, because in most established sports, you do have to start very young if you want to have any chance at all. And even when I got to Maui, windsurfing was still relatively new, but there was a very established group of competitors that ruled the sport. And when I got here, I wasn't even a blip on the radar. But what I had going for me was I had a love and a passion for the sport that was all-encompassing. It was all I did. It was all I thought about. It was all I ever wanted to do. So I spent all day, every day in the water, quite honestly, with no competitive aspirations, which might seem odd to do something that much and not want to be a champion at it. But I just loved the sport, and I was having so much fun that I was probably putting in more time than anybody. And I think that helped propel me up to a competitive level. But the other thing I think I had going for me was, because I had no competitive aspirations, I had no pressure.
Right.
I did it because I loved it. I did it because I was having fun. I covered extreme amount of ground. Basically, in a year and a half's time, I got to a level where, not that I was beating the world's best, but that I could at least compete with them. And at about 3 years into competing, I was now starting to beat some of the best. But I think it all comes back to the fact that I had no competitive aspirations. I absolutely loved the sport as much as anybody in the world did. And so I gave it everything I had because I loved it so much.
Now, Dave, I don't have much experience with surfing, but I do have, like, some experience windsurfing. You know, we go casually on the lake once a year on vacation and whatnot. And we still have the old giant heavy board. When you started, what were the boards like? And, like, I see them now, the guys out there with these, you know, these amazing boards that look like they weigh close to nothing. How have you seen technology change windsurfing alone, before we even get into all the other types of surfing you do?
It sounds like you, when I first got into windsurfing, it was just something we did up on the lakes in the summer.
Right.
In Mammoth. It was just, one of my friends brought it down one summer because his parents had bought it for him, and so he shared it with the rest of us. And we just flew out and we surf and hang out and just have fun. And it wasn't until I moved to Maui that I kind of went from a very casual user to an intense user, let's say. But it was very serendipitous, and it was very casual in the beginnings. And to try and answer your question more specifically, the technology part of it, yes, with the advent, well, when windsurfing got going, it was, the boards were being made surfers, so they were bringing surf technology to it, and the beginning windsurfers were essentially just the same materials, just a larger version of a surfboard.
Right.
And so they were quite heavy. And then a lot of the board manufacturers, as this grew and became a larger industry, started really researching alternative forms of materials because the weight was such an issue. And so in comes styrofoam, in comes epoxy, and that sends them down a rabbit hole that comes with carbon and sandwich construction and all these different components and methods of construction that ultimately lead windsurfers to the cutting edge of surf technology now. And the boards are much lighter by volume than any surfboard or any other board made for water at that point.
Now, when windsurfing started to be get more attention and started getting into competition, how did the regular, I don't know how you'd say it, the original surfing community look at it? Did they look at it as, okay, this is an equal to what we're doing, or was it almost like kind of shunned, like how some skiers look at snowboarders?
Very much shunned, looked down upon, not real surfing. All those kind of secondary tier opinions and stigmas were placed on it. And justified, because it was pulling in people that had no familiarity with surfing or the culture of surfing or a picking order work in surfing. And so you were getting people that really were abrasive in the lineups because they had no familiarity with how surfing worked. And it was such, surfing at that time was very Wild West-ish and jungle rules, let's say.
So now, are you just naturally good at anything that involves balance in water? Because, you know, I look at your resume or whatever, and you got stand-up paddleboarding, which we'll get to in a minute, windsurfing, surfing, canoe racing. What did you kind of bounce from thing to thing, or was it more of whatever you felt that day or that week you're going to work on?
You know, I had a certain amount of talent, yes. But was I ever the most talented? No. I unequivocally believe I was the water. What I had going for me was, like in the beginning of windsurfing, when I found something new that I liked, boy, I jumped in feet first, head over heels, and would fully commit myself to it and figure it out because, and I have much more perspective now looking back. I really enjoyed learning. I enjoyed cracking the code on things and figuring them out as any aspect of anything I've ever done.
So let me ask you, when did you decide, when it's become quite the trend and fun thing to do down the shore and you see it all over, when did you come up with the idea of stand-up paddleboarding?
It started with Laird Hamilton and myself one day doing a photo shoot. And at the time, we were riding 12-foot longboards almost primarily. And the waves were very small on this particular day. And the wind was offshore. And we'd ride a wave in. And we'd continue to stand on our boards because they were big enough. And we'd let the wind blow us back out to the lineup. And we got tired of just standing there. And I happened to have a couple of canoe paddles in the back of my truck, so I ran in and grabbed them so that we wouldn't have to just stand there idly waiting for the wind to blow us back out. We could continue to stand, but paddle. And so we could get back out quicker. And we were laughing and having fun with it, and we kind of realized, like, well, that's kind of a good way to get back to the lineup, and you can still surf, and you know, there's kind of something to this. And while I didn't take it extremely serious or think it was revolutionary at the time, I just thought it was fun. Laird went and got some paddles made for us that were much longer, so we didn't have to bend over to reach the water with the short little canoe paddles.
Right.
And we were kind of off and running. And it just, to me, it was another fun thing to do. It wasn't, it didn't become the only thing I would do, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine that that day you pictured women doing yoga classes on these paddle boards.
I didn't see it getting as big as it did, but I certainly was caught off guard by yoga stand-up. I never saw that coming.
And why do you think it took off like that? Like, because it's definitely, I mean, me and my fiance have done it a few times. We very much enjoy it. Why do you think it, did blow up?
You know, a few things it had going for it. It was attached to the surf culture because of who sort of was originating it and where it came from. So that was attractive. And then the next thing I would say is it was very accessible. The barrier of entry was extremely low, meaning you could do it in very calm water,
yep,
at a very slow pace, and you could inch your way into it, which makes it not intimidating, right? And so I think that between all those things, and then you saw the pictures of Jennifer Aniston and a couple other movie stars doing it in People magazine, and boom, it was, everyone wanted to do it.
Now, you brought up Laird Hamilton. I mean, as I was reading up on your career, pretty much a ton of things, everything that pops up, his name pops up into toe windsurfing, some movies that you've done together, some awards you received together. What's it like to have kind of like a partner along with in this like growing competition and doing something that you love like surfing?
It was fantastic. Having a partner like Laird was fantastic. And I kind of compare it to sort of like how Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen were perhaps the most dynamic duo in sports. He was Michael Jordan. I think that was pretty much understood by everybody, which, made me, Scottie Pippen, a fantastic player in his own right. But, I used to get a lot of questions like, don't you ever get jealous? And what's it like being number two to, the best guy? And, let's be realistic. That was what was going on. But I never really looked at it that way. I always looked at it like, Laird is the leader of our group, and we're climbing a mountain. And the more I help him, the further up I get to go. And I went so much further than I honestly ever thought I would go, that it became icing on the cake long, long, long time ago. And so that helped me keep a good attitude. It really helped. We're both pretty alpha males, but the teamwork allowed us to go further than we ever could have as individuals.
That is a great way to look at it. One thing I thought I found really cool that you got to do, and I watched it today prior to doing this interview, but you got to do a TED Talk. That has to be pretty cool, like going from everything surfing, all that, and then all of a sudden you're extending your reach to people all over the world that watch all these TED Talks. What was that experience like?
Well, I have to admit, when I was asked to do it, I was very unfamiliar with what TED was. And so I just looked at it as another goofy thing that I probably should do to learn how to public speak better. And, I was like, all right, I'll do it. And they kept asking me for an outline or write out your speech. Tell us what you're going to do. And I kept blowing them off and a couple weeks out, they're like, hey, we really need that outline. We got to know what you're going to do. And I kept blowing them off. And finally, rehearsal comes the day before you're supposed to go. And so I show up at rehearsal and I go, look, I'm sorry I didn't send you a thing, but I'm just going to tell a story. That's all I got. and I don't need to write it down, and you're either going to like it and we'll go, and if you don't, then just let me know, and no big deal. So I show up to rehearsal, I tell them the story, and they go, we get it. Now I see why you didn't write anything. You're good to go. Don't worry about it. And at the time, I'm still thinking, you know, what Ted, I don't know what Ted is. Some, you know, I still didn't know what a TED Talk was, per se, at that point. And it just seemed like a bunch of geeks that get together and talk about computers and stuff like that. I didn't even know what TED stood for. And so anyway, I show up to the auditorium, and there's people with walkie-talkies, and you need to go get makeup on. And you can hear the people out on stage talking, and I peek my head through, and I can see thousands of people. And I'm like, whoa, this is kind of a big deal. But, you know, I start to get a little nervous, and I'm like, well, look, you haven't cared up to this point. Don't start caring now because you might get nervous. So I just kept telling myself, look, you know, relax. Do what you do, and they're either going to like it or they won't. But at least you're going home tonight. You're not going to drown. So how bad could it be, you know?
Okay, it could be pretty bad. I bombed many times, and I wanted to drown. So
I walked out there, and this, you know, for sure I was nervous. But I just kept saying to myself, look, you know, you haven't cared to this point. Don't start now. Just tell your story. And I got into it after a few minutes, and I got a little bit of reaction from the crowd, and you start to feed off of that, and then you start to have fun with it.
Yeah, I mean, it came out great, so it definitely worked. But it's got to be a cool experience because you see some of the people like that have also done these TED Talks, and they are, you know, they're just from all walks of life. So well, it's pretty neat.
You know, it's funny. It's from that experience, I, you know, obviously wanted to know a lot more about TED. And now I listen to TED Talks probably every other day from the podcast.
Yep.
And absolutely love the information that they make available. It's awesome.
Hey, now, let me ask you something about competition. Now, me and Scott have been lucky enough to talk to a bunch of different people in a bunch of different sports. One coming to mind is Stephen LeBeau, Red Bull cliff diver. And we've always brought up the latest scares with concussions. Has there been a fear that has come through with all this latest information with surfers since you're dealing with falls of 50, 60, 100 feet in competitions where they're looking into possible safety features or anything?
As far as concussions go, no. It's not high on the priority list of needs concerning safety. What absolutely is the most number one safety concern? Where did I drop out at?
All right, you dropped out at a pretty epic point. You're like, the number one concern in surfing is, and then it dropped
dun, dun, dun.
Right there.
And please join us next week for episode 2 when we find out what's so important. No. All right. So what the number one concern in big wave surfing in terms of safety is air. Then getting to the surface and getting air. Air, right?
Yep.
When you're underwater and you're trying to get back to the surface, air is all that matters. And so the number one safety feature in surfing is air. And that is such a huge focal point, because yes, there are concussions and there's broken bones and stitches and all these other things that can happen, but all of those seem insignificant compared to drowning.
So how do they go about trying to, I guess you can't ever completely prevent it, but like, what safety measures do go into, you know, prevention of drowning and whatnot?
Well, we introduced flotation, like water skiing vests, as a means of flotation and dealing with it.
Right.
And now since then, what's been developed in the last few years, like divers use, where it isn't necessarily inflated all the time, but when you need it, you pull on a cord and it expands rapidly and more so than what we used to wear. And so it really helps pull you back up to the surface quickly.
That's good. Now, that segues nicely into the question I wanted to ask you before we go. How is you've been doing this so long in so many different ways? I'm sure that you have gone through injury and punch. How is your body holding up? And do you have any permanent injuries that are really, kind of nagging?
Well, I'm holding up okay. And until about 5 years ago, I honestly felt I was superhuman. And then I had a neck injury, not from any one traumatic experience, but my neck had been through so much abuse that it got to a point where the disc was shrinking. And I ultimately had a pinched nerve in my neck. And that came with a lot of atrophy in the right side of my upper body and pain. And it shut me down for quite some time. And it probably took a good year and a half to fully recover from.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I realized I'm human. And that sucked. And... but it was sort of it was the beginning of the end for me pushing it, because I had to sort of reevaluate, how much more can I really do? How important is it to you? Break my neck or pinch a nerve so bad or it becomes so bad I can't work or take care of my family anymore, then, that really doesn't help anybody. So that started to rein me in and kind of come back to reality. So, it's a psychological process that you have to go through at the end of. It's significant, and you really have to do a lot of soul searching to work your way through it.
All right.
Dave, we really enjoyed talking to you. I know our time is running short, so it's really important I get this question now. Do people on that island really like Hawaiian pizza? Because I got a theory this is just a made-up story that only Scott Brennan likes this stuff.
Love me a Hawaiian pizza.
Well, personally, I love Hawaiian pizza.
Yes.
But yeah. Over here, they don't call it Hawaiian pizza. They just call it pizza.
So they do like pineapple, though, on their pizza, correct? This has been a debate between me and Mike for quite a long time, and I'm glad I'm coming out on the right side of this.
Well, I don't know if I can speak for all Hawaiians, but I sure like it on my pizza.
Dave, you're always welcome here on the podcast. And in fact, if you're looking, as surfing's starting to wind down, if you're looking for like a co-hosting job, I could easily replace Mike.
Yeah. It only takes 50 states to find somebody, Scotty. Good for you.
Does that mean 49. I have to live in Georgia?
No, just Jersey. Yeah. Just Jersey. No. You can stay right where you are. But Dave, thank you so much for your time. What can fans and people hear in this, and what kind of piece together the dropouts and whatnot? What can they look forward to, and where can they go to check out? What kind of projects you got going on right now?
Well, I have a website, davidkalama.com, which has a lot of fun stories and information about stand-up paddling on it. If you are still on Facebook, given the recent situation, I am on there, so you can follow me there. And then on Instagram is Dave Kalama.
Dave, thank you so much for giving us some time. It's just really cool to talk, and we appreciate it.
Appreciate it, man.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
It's such a cool interview. It just, that's the only thing that stinks is the connection sometimes, and these places can be a little suspect, and it's kind of hard to dial in unless it's like a landline. Or I mean, he was in the car, so.
yeah.
But
that's the craziest thing, and it's you figure this is, world is so together and all, and then it's like I'm not within my cell tower. So.
Yeah, but it's also on the other side of that, it's crazy. Like I was telling you with last week's episode, I did that interview with the guy with Peter from Sweden, you know, and he's from the Netherlands, and we've done, you know, we've talked to people in Europe, we've talked to people on remote islands, we've talked to people in Nova Scotia, you know, so it is amazing, even though, you know, sometimes you don't get the best quality of just because of the power of the internet and whatnot, we've been able to put stuff together and talk to people like that. So,
That and porn.
I could pick that guy's brain for a long time. I'm pretty fascinated by like the surf, like just culture of surfing, like
the culture. Yeah,
you know, it's a whole lifestyle. And this guy, it's just cool to see how many times he's, you know, he's involved in like five different types of surfing and has been successful at them all. Yeah. And you know, he's done a lot of stuff. So Dave Kalema.
Well, that just proves his love, you know. I mean, the fact that they keep on finding stuff and go, oh, this is fun, and just evolve it and all. That's what keeps it running, you know, for years to come.
And I don't know. Maybe I'm off here. Maybe I'm, like, a little off. But, like, you know, through video and, like, TV and stuff like that, anytime you see surfers always still seem to they always seem to be having fun. Like, even in the I don't know. It seems like it's, like, a very, like, easygoing brotherhood. Of course, there's like competition, but they always seem to like be in the moment and getting along, and you know, not, you know, that whole California Hawaii vibe.
Yeah, you don't hear about the John Rocker equivalent in the surfing world. You just don't. Somebody's out there.
He might be doing that now. there's a very good possibility John Rocker is like a big wave surfer somewhere.
But, we got to look him up.
Yeah. But the one and only Dave Kalema, that was cool. Let's take a quick break. All right, buddy. I think it's time for our second guest. I think we're staying with an all Hawaii cast tonight.
Mm. I think we should call this our 50th episode. so we can name it Hawaii 5. Oh,
I was thinking we could say we're bringing all the aloha-has.
Oh, dude, we got to go on stage and use both of them jokes.
Who we got?
We're coming to us tonight from Hawaii is the director of facilities and submersal ops for the Hurl or Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory, Mr. Terry Kirby.
Can you say
the acronym they use, by the way, Hurl.
Can you say that again without reading? Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory in the School of Ocean and Earth Science and Technology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. At least they kept it nice and short.
Mm-hmm. Just say girl.
Yeah. But all right, so we're going to give Terry Kirby a call, and back to Hawaii we go.
Good afternoon, girl.
Hey, is this Terry?
Speaking.
Terry, it's Scott from Verbal Shenanigans. Give me 1 second. I'm just going to merge Mike into the call real quick.
Okay.
All right. Mike, can you hear us?
I can hear you, Scotty.
All right, Terry. Again, this is I'm Scott. That's Mike there on the other line. So right now we are connecting New Jersey, Georgia, and Hawaii. So pretty cool.
All right.
But so Terry, this is actually the second guest tonight from Hawaii on the same episode. So it's pretty cool to kind of tie it all together here. We just had Dave Kalema on the surfer. So thanks for giving us a few minutes here on the show.
Oh, good to be here.
Now, first off, the acronym HURL, okay, Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory. I'm on your site now, and there's a lot of different things on it. Where did this start? Did you start as a student in this? Did you found this yourself? What exactly is this?
Well, no, actually, I started working with the submersible Star II here in the mid-70s, and that submersible was donated to the University of Hawaii. And this program started in 1981 as the Hawaiian Undersea Research Lab, which was part of NOAA's National Undersea Research Program through the University of Hawaii. The little sub was called the Makalii, actually started this. So I started with that submersible when the HURL program started. So I started as operations director and chief pilot when that program started in 1981. And then we eventually went from that little sub to the Pisces, so expanded our operating depth capability from 1,200 feet to 6,500 feet.
All right. What's involved in doing adventures like that at such a depth? Can anybody like join in on one of these adventures, or do you have to go through like rigorous training to get your body adept to depths that below?
Well, no, the beauty of manned submersible operations is you're always at one atmosphere. So you can climb in the sub, and our normal dives are about 8 hours long. We usually launch about 8 o'clock in the morning, and we're back on deck by 5 p.m. So you can get in the sub and go over a mile down and stay there for a good part of the day and come back up and just open the hatch and get out. There's no depth-related issues because you're inside a protected command sphere. You're always at one atmosphere. And the program was actually started as a program that was supported by NOAA, so scientists from all over could put in proposals for a wide range of different science missions and apply for support missions with the submersibles. So our little operations crew, there's just six of us that operate two Pisces subs here. Now, it's the same crew that takes them apart and puts them together and takes them to sea and operates them and does the dive seasons. So we may be involved in a wide range of different science missions, from diving on active submarine volcanoes to doing deep coral reef ecosystem surveys, fisheries surveys. We've done a lot of historic wreck surveys. We found so far about 140 different historic targets off of South Oahu that are considered submerged cultural resources that we've done over the years. So it's been 37 years of operations all throughout the Pacific Basin with the Pisces subs.
Now let's talk about the sub itself. Like, I'm guessing it takes a certain kind of person to kind of want to be able to spend that much time. What are like the physical requirements in order to kind of operate the vehicle?
Well, the command sphere on the submersibles is about a 7-foot diameter sphere for a crew of three. So it's usually pilot and two science observers. So you can actually stand up and stretch your legs and walk around in a small circle. But that's that command sphere. There's three forward-looking viewports. They're a conical design, and the conical design slightly overlaps. So if I'm there in the pilot's position and I have a science observer on each side of me and we're looking out at our sample tray and somebody says, can you collect that rock? I can take my laser pointer and say, you mean that one right there, and pick it up, and everybody can sort of see what's going on. It has two mechanical arms. So one is very dexterous. It's like an extension of your own body. And the two arms together give us excellent capability to manipulate instruments and collect really fragile little organisms and open and close box lids and do a wide range of work. So it's the Pisces design is a really excellent, rugged, working-class design. And so they're good for all different types of terrain.
Tell us a little bit about some of your events. I've researched some about you, and it talks about so many crazy things like sea volcanoes, underwater mountains, ghost ships. What kind of pushes, what kind of adventure you guys go out with? Do you generally work with the same people, or is it just randomly somebody contracts you for a mission?
Well, it's been a wide, there's some users have ongoing science projects. We did the first Pisces dive on our own Hawaiian hotspot volcano Lauihi in 1987, and we did about 15, well, actually altogether, it's been about 18 years of exploration on that volcano. And the first time I did a drop down on that volcano, I'm thinking, what am I doing diving a submersible onto an active volcano? And but after about 9 years of taking scientists and instruments to that volcano, we're going, well, this sleepy old volcano is never going to do anything. And then in 1996, there was a major surge of over 4,000 major seismic events, and there was a major collapse on the caldera. So the pinnacle that I had been taking scientists to for 9 years that came up to 975 meters had disappeared into a giant crater half a mile wide and half a mile long, and went from 975 meters to 1,330 meters in less than 10 days. So we had a lot of respect for that volcano after that. But we did dives on the Kermadec Arc. We did a five-month expedition diving on 13 active submarine volcanoes between Samoa and New Zealand, and they were completely different. So we learned a lot of lessons on those volcanoes as well. But it's sort of the projects range from volcano exploration to maritime heritage, historic wreck site surveys, and fisheries operations. We just, in 2017, we did 2 months. It was altogether 3 months of seamount exploration all the way up to the Emperor Seamounts down the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And the main mission was to survey these deep coral ecosystems at depths around 400 to 500 meters and up shallower. So we're doing surveys to assess the impact of commercial fishing. And the Pisces, with two subs together, could cover a significant amount of terrain and bring back images and really bring back the message of the types of impact in these unprotected seamounts versus the ancient and healthy deep coral systems on the seamounts that are protected in the monument. So it was really a really interesting project and a really worthwhile project.
Now, who funds these projects and how do they come about? Is there a board that votes on what you guys are going to be doing next? Do you know the exact length of time certain missions are going to take? How does the pre-planning happen? And also, where do you guys get funding from?
Well, we used to, from 1981 until 2012, we were part of NOAA's National Sea Research Program through the University of Hawaii. So NOAA funded the core funding for the operation, and scientists from all over could put in requests for proposals to put in different projects that were funded by NOAA. In 2012, NOAA disbanded the National Undersea Research Program and no longer supported that. So we're part of the University of Hawaii. So now the burden was on the University of Hawaii to try to provide support. So we have been basically on the endangered species list since 2012, but have managed to go out and get dive programs to keep dive operations going. But every year since 2012, we've been threatened with extinction. So there's no base core support funding for the program. It mainly has been going out and having different science groups come in and contract dives. But there's only eight of these in the world that are deep diving research submersibles that are supported by institutes. And the Pisces 4 and Pisces 5 are considered the shallow diving of the world's population of eight deep diving at the only 6,500 feet. But because of that, we do a lot of work in shallower areas where the fact of life in shallow diving is you encounter a lot more entanglement hazards. So with a two-sub operation, we really have a significant advantage of having both subs on the bottom. It's a lot more productivity, and your safety backup capability is right there, usually on the bottom with you or 45 minutes away on the support ship.
Now, I always hear, like lately with the government, how they're talking about they want to explore more into space to kind of see if there's resources that we can use or anything like that. Has there been anything government-wise where they've looked into kind of the opposite, like looking to see what's at the depths of the ocean and possibly see if there's any kind of, you know, materials or anything of note that could be used and help fund the organization?
Well, there is a huge need for that right now worldwide. And the Pacific is really an arena that's opening up for exploration and exploitation and protection. But there really are very few assets out there that are available to do that. The unique thing about the Pisces is that we have been successfully and safely operating in a wide range of terrain and a wide range of conditions for over three decades now, all throughout the Pacific Basin. So some of that work that we do in types of terrain on seamounts and on atolls, where you get into really rugged, vertical to overhanging carbonate terrain that you can't operate in with tethered vehicles, the Pisces are still the best tool for that type of work, because we can work up really shallow. I mean, we can work from 20 meters down to 2,000 meters. So it gives us a really unique capability for exploration in the Pacific, and there's a lot more need for that. So it's just a manage. It's just a idea of trying to hang on and keep these assets operational so they're not lost. Because right now, with the capabilities and the expertise, everything is in place right now, centered right in the center of the Pacific. And every year, there's a danger of losing that. But there is definitely a demand for more and more exploration now and in the Pacific.
Now, so what are you guys currently working on now? Like, what is the goal of the operations? And, like, is there a way these days for, like, people who are interested in it to kind of follow along or even see footage from what you guys? Is there any kind of interactive part of this?
Well, our website, which hasn't, there's a lot of information on our website on the different types of missions that we've been involved in. And one of the things that's happening right now is that the decades of operations that we have done, the video and the images and the pilot's report, is all being made available on that website for anybody to be able to access. So that means if the program of these subs are lost and the program is shut down, the decades of investment on ocean exploration is still going to be available. So that's one of the things that's happening right now to try and keep that all that information available.
Looking at your bio, you've been part of the Coast Guard, you've been part doing work up in Alaska since the 70s. What makes you so fascinated and love the water so much and want to keep going on with it for four decades now?
Well, I have been intrigued by submersibles since I was a little kid. And in 1975 or 76, I was going around the island here on Oahu, and there was this crane picking this little submersible out of the water. So I went down to check it out. I had just gotten out of the Coast Guard, and I went down to check it out. And I had gone through a deep sea diving institute, so I was a diver, and then I kind of expanded on that. Went through the Coastal School of Deep Sea Diving, and I came down and checked out the operation just to take a look at the sub. And they just happened to need a diver for their submersible launch platform, thing called an LRT, that's sort of unique in the world in itself. It's a submersible platform that the sub is secured on and towed to a site, and three divers operate it, and you submerge to a midwater depth about 60 feet to launch and recover the sub. It's very unique. It's my first experience. I remember swimming to the edge of the LRT and looking over the side and knowing that it's 1,200 feet straight down, and we're hanging out in midwater like a space station with the sub launching and recovering. And there was no looking back after that. Even after 40 years of piloting, every time I climb in that sub and close the hatch, it's still the same rush. It's still like the first time. And undersea exploration is always new. It's always exciting.
Now, is there ever a time that you came across like a ton of danger or some kind of emergency happened while under, or have you pretty much had 40 years of smooth sailing?
Well, I would say that in 40 years of piloting, and I have my share of what I would call inconveniences, but nothing I would consider life-threatening. The subs have lots of backup capabilities. I would say the biggest hazard, especially for subs that are doing shallow diving work, where you're doing work and for fisheries surveys and areas where you can find a lot of trap lines and anchor lines and nets and long lines, that I've been hung up, I think two times, just twice, and I managed to get myself out of it both times. And having a second submersible has really allowed us to do types of operations that we would normally would not do if we didn't have an immediate backup capability. But it's like diving with a buddy system. We've actually gone down there with the subs and get together and exchange samplers out of each other's baskets. And we're pretty used to
like wine that, tastings down there, or
I don't think that I can't really think of any situation I've been in that I would consider life threatening. We did have some interesting lessons when we did the dives on the Kermadec volcanoes. Those volcanoes were some of them very active, and we learned a lot of volcano lessons on that 5 months of exploration on those 13 active volcanoes. And on one dive, I unwittingly was sitting on top of what I thought was a nice sandy bottom, but it was a sand-covered bottom on a crust of a molten lake of sulfur, and we only found out later we're sitting on. So, you know, it's the subs are really excellent, rugged tools for that kind of exploration. So once that sub becomes a part of your body, you're actually pretty safe in that sub. And submersibles, historically, go back to the 60s, have been proven to be pretty safe means of deep ocean exploration.
Now, when you're doing these deep, deep dives and you're dealing with aquatic life that's probably never even seen like light or anything like that, how do they react when you're like coming through and all? Do they just kind of keep on swimming and think nothing of it, or are they just like entranced by whatever this thing is in front of them?
Oh, that's some of the most fascinating part of the dive. Just the behavior of some of these deep sea creatures are mostly really curious, and we'll have them. I'd say one of my favorite types of fish is the grouper. In Hawaii, what they call hapupu. It's the only one that is so curious. They'll swim right up to the sub and look you right in the face and stare in the viewport, their eyes going all over, checking everything out. We've had some fish really opportunistic, like there's a yellow-tailed jack that in Hawaii is called a kahala. And where a lot of other animals get sort of blinded by the light, it seems the kahala doesn't faze them at all, and they'll usually cruise along the sub and use the lights to hunt with. So they'll find some little fish that's gotten too far out of their burrow, and it's like firing a torpedo. They're pretty effective, and then they'll get back, and so it doesn't take them very long to figure out how to use the subs to hunt. But we've had really large, like six-gill sharks that are just so curious, they'll just come right up and nose the sub and check it out. But the animals are what's fascinating. And there's so many. And when we did the dives on the Kermadec volcanoes, I think, and 40 years of submersible piloting, that is still a highlight. I mean, the seamount exploration we did last year was just magical. Some of the areas that we saw, it was just heartbreaking with the devastation from the fisheries, but areas that had been protected were fine, whole 500-meter transects through really dense, ancient, pristine coral beds and coral forests that some scientists consider to be the keystone communities that drive the ocean machine on these seamounts. But the volcano dives, every one of those volcanoes was different. And you would dive on one, and there would be hydrothermal activity where the you would have this chemosynthetic sea life that have acres and acres of mussels, and we have a main predator, and these mussels be these red crabs all battling in these mussel beds with tube worms. And then you'd go 10 miles down the road and dive on another volcano, and there'd be acres of mussels and not a single crab there, and all these multicolored starfish would be the main predators in the mussel beds. And it just, everyone was unique, and it was just incredible. Where there was sulfur, there was life. Those volcano dives were absolutely fascinating. That was 5 months, and I was I've been ready to go back for more ever since.
Wow.
I mean, it sounds like you have like endless experiences doing this, and that there's a whole lot more to go. So, where can people go to get more information, or see what you've done, or see pictures, and also get some information on the organization itself?
So the I think our website right now is the best option. When NOAA discontinued this program in 2012, we had sort of a core administrative part of the operation with a data manager and that basically specifically looked after that site. All that basically evaporated and left nothing but the operations team, but we still have personnel at the university. They're still trying to maintain these decades of information from this exploration that the Pisces have done over the years. So I'd say the HURL website is the best place to start, to go online, to start getting access to that. So there is an effort right now to try and maintain and upgrade the HURL website. So I'd say that'd be the place to start.
Awesome.
And one final question, as we asked our last guest, as I'm trying to still figure this whole thing out. Scott is a huge fan of Hawaiian pizza, and I don't get it. So as a Hawaiian, I need to know, are you a fan of the Hawaiian pizza?
Don't let me down, Terry.
The Hawaiian pizza, I have to admit, I haven't really tried the Hawaiian pizza, so I can't speak in authority.
What?
Scotty,
I have some of my crew that I have some of my crew here. I'm sure have. I know some of them probably.
So you've explored the deepest depths of the ocean, but have not explored pineapples on
the
pizza.
Hawaiian pizza. No,
well, you're going to have to report back to us. Terry, thank you so much for some time. It's really fascinating. Could pick your brain for a long time. So thanks for giving us some time, and we enjoyed it.
That was my pleasure.
All right. So one Hawaiian confirmed it's good. One Hawaiian is no.
It's his biggest mystery in life.
Yeah, he's sitting out of this argument. So. So far, I'm in the lead here. I'm in the lead.
Yeah, it's just one day. Let's try the other 49. See how you rank.
Let's get more Hawaiians. let's just tweet out to Hawaiians right now. But
is this Don Ho Jr.?
Is this Rikishi Fatu? But yep, Terry Kirby. We learned that Hawaiian pizza is great today. We learned
It didn't get the entire vote. I'm sorry.
Listen, as we have learned, it's all about just winning enough votes. You don't need to win the popular vote.
What's Hawaii like? 6 electoral college votes?
Probably not even. I'd be curious. I'd be interested. But yes, so we all Hawaii, both really cool guys. So, just another good week of guests.
Mm-hmm.
So what else?
Very much so.
What else you got, Mike? How is life living with the parents? I did it for a little while. We did cast from there. You used to laugh at me when my mom or someone would come down to do she'd be like, "Mom, I'm doing a podcast," and you just had your own little moment there, like a little while ago.
Yeah, so I went into the secondary room. This will be my brother's room for a little bit. He's selling his house, and until he buys his house.
So the whole Berlew clan is coming back.
Most of us. The sister is staying up in New Jersey. But
all you're missing is a toothbrush costume and...
Yes, a reference that everybody on the show will get.
Well, that's what we generally
do. With no
do.
Explanation.
That's what we generally do. Okay, but, so the Berlew clan is getting back together.
Yeah, so I went into the back room just because last week I got a little chewed out from the girlfriend because I locked the door just to have some privacy on the podcast, and she was got upset by that, so I went to the back room, and apparently these blankets that were on this bed were quote-unquote good blankets. The good blankets have been sitting here for months that nobody's been on.
Obi found something.
See, even Obi's chiming in on this. He's like, that's ridiculous.
I sleep on the good blankets all the time.
Shut up, Obi.
So, yeah, it was a weird moment as we're trying to cast where my mom peeks in and she's like peeling the blanket off the one bed because there's two, like, twin beds in here, and then she's giving me emotion like, I'm like, what? I'm on the podcast. You want me to get off the bed? Yes.
So how has life been adjusting? I know, like, it took me a little while to kind of get used to things. I kind of felt like I was always bumping into them cross, you know, in common spaces and whatnot. Are you getting any of that?
No, I wouldn't say. My parents got a pretty big house in here. So, I mean, we all generally, you know, go into the living room and just chit-chat for a while. But when we all do our own thing, we just all go out. And it's not a concern of bumping into each other. So there's no cramming of styles yet right now. So, but you know me, I'll find a way, you know.
I'll find a way to mess this all up. All right. Well.
God, there's a lot of good blankets in this place. Damn.
I ruined all the good blankets. Now I have no home. But, all right. Well, good.
Yeah. I am dealing with a fever blister on my forehead right now, which is discouraging me right now.
I can kind of say...
let me try to get it.
Oh, this is lovely. Is that above your right eye, you mean? Oh, there it is.
Yeah.
What is that?
According to the doctor, he thinks it's like a fever blister. I'm somewhat concerned.
That's it short for AIDS,
poison,
right?
Poison ivy, or what's that?
That's another word for AIDS, right?
Yeah, the Georgia AIDS.
I contracted Georgian AIDS.
Yeah, that one girl in the back room they call fever. That's fever blisters.
On the streets of Augusta.
Yeah, so it's been an awkward... I've had it for a couple days now, and it's like almost like in a diamond shape, so I put stuff on it. I'm taking some steroids for it to heal, but it just makes me look like I'm some dork in like a superhero kind of outfit and all. Like that's the first thing of makeup and all. I got the powers. I got the diamond head.
Maybe you're like Vision. You know, like he had that thing in his forehead.
Yeah.
But
I'm hoping Thanos rips this thing off my head right now. It's just quite annoying and all. Like nobody said anything at work, but I'm sure it's like, you know, what is that thing?
The new guy's got a weird red head. What's going on there? you know, maybe...
Is that a Jersey thing?
Maybe you fit in now because, you know, like those meth rashes that people get, that when they do meth, they get like red rashes all over themselves. So maybe that's the image you're putting out.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't recall doing meth, but then again, most meth heads don't either, so...
Well, so what is it called? A fever rash? A fever blister, you said?
A fever blister. Like, he basically said, like, most people will get it, like, by their mouth and all, just like a regular blister. But, the best thing you could say is if it's not itching or doing anything weird, that's his best guess. I'm really hoping I didn't, like, coming into some like poison ivy or anything like that, but it's not like itchy or anything, but it's just weird. And it's up in my scalp, so every time I brush my hair in the morning, you know, it gets really aggravating, you know, dealing with that.
Shave
it. Just the constant reminder.
Shave your head.
Well, then I'll see it more. At least I only got the diamond. It'd be a diamond and whatever's left over there. No, it might be the Hawaiian Islands to salute tonight's episode.
And yeah, you got a nice little Maui forehead going on right now. Is it itchy?
It's not itchy. It's just there, for lack of a better term. You like every time you go in the bathroom, you just look at it.
Do you notice it a lot more or less when you are making voices in the mirror? Does it change your character at all?
I've yet to do mirror voices down in Georgia. It hasn't caught on yet. So
have you done
one day? Like when it clears up, I'll be feeling good. I'll be like, don't mess with me.
Have you done mirror voices since even, like, has Izzy ever caught you doing mirror voices?
I think you've been pretty much the only one where I've been mirror.
I
was really tired that day.
Now, are mirror voices a thing? Like, is that something that happens more than, it had to happen than just the one incident I heard you being a cowboy in my bathroom.
I guess when I was alone, like practicing some stuff, see for like comedy, you know, see what would work, and I would do it in the mirror. But I mean,
no,
like out of the blue, just
what roles were you? What act were you trying to go for as the you don't mess with me? You're not gonna was that your shtick? You were gonna be the you don't mess with me guy? Like you've seen him, you've seen him in clubs and colleges all up the East Coast. He's also the you don't mess with me guy.
5 minutes ago.
guys, he's not coming out yet, but I'll tell you right now, he's in the bathroom getting ready.
Oh, I've been listening to his stuff. It sounds great.
He's primed. He's prepped. He's ready to blow your socks off. Mike, you don't mess with me. Burlew.
Woo! All the t-shirts at the end.
I'm a big, yeah. You don't mess with me.
I'm going to be at the table over there after the show. I know you'll be getting your checks, but don't mess with me. $15, all sizes.
They're usually $15, but today they're $10. Today they're $10. Yeah. I will sign it too. I'm a big rehearsal of my comedy in the shower.
Okay.
That is basically a lot of nights when I am too lazy to go to an open mic and I know that like Alex is not home or something like that, I will full out have the bottle of shampoo in my hand because it's like a feeling type of thing. You got to know what to do with your hand. And I will try new material to the audience in the shower.
Now, are you acting like a stage where you're going walking back and forth in the shower, talking to people, like making gestures?
No, I'm not. I don't do too much crowd work in the shower. But,
no.
I will definitely say that early on in stand-up, when I was like very, very, very new, I would almost like, and I'm sure everyone's kind of done this before when they start. I was like, I would write a bit and then I would almost write in like, you know what I'm talking about. So, or like, this is where I'll say, you know, like this is where I will say something to the crowd. And it gives me like,
was that your catchphrase and all? You would like just throw out a punchline and be like, you know what I'm talking about.
No, like you know, or like if I build a question in, like I'll ask the audience a question here. And very early on, you realize that never works. It just got to kind of come off the cuff and natural. But, man, I will still definitely like run a set in my head or a new joke in my head in the shower for sure.
That's why a lot of times when you see him on stage, he's buck naked.
It just
feels natural, people. You just got to go with it.
Or still have like soap suds in my hair, you know.
I'm pointing to you. What are you drinking, you know? No, I'm pointing to you with this thing.
Yeah, I had a Oh, yeah, I did Wisecrackers in Allentown, Pennsylvania on Friday and Saturday. We had a we had a flat earth believer in the crowd.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, they do exist.
Who was it? Was it Drake?
No, I will give you I'll give you like a couple chances to kind of guess what this person looked like.
Okay, I'm going to say mid-50s.
Nope. Think the opposite of that.
Like the 20s?
Yes.
Wow.
Now, what would like a douchey flat earth believer kind of like, what hairstyle do you think this guy would go with?
I'm going to say kind of like a slick back, kind of greasy hair.
No, he had he was rocking like a almost like a man bun, like a ponytail, on top of his head.
Uh-huh.
He was the same guy like every time. You know, there was a joke that he liked to be like, "Yeah, yeah, man, yeah."
I need the comedian to know that I appreciate his work. So I'm going to yell after every punchline. Oh!
And he was straight up like the guy Tyler. I was hosting the guy Tyler was featuring, and I'm listening. Tyler said something along the lines of, "We got flat Earth believers in this audience," and one of the, and he's like, "Yeah!" And like Tyler's like, you know, like kind of like, "You don't actually believe that?" He's like, "Hell yeah, I do." And he's like, he started like talking shit back to him, like, "Yeah, like." I forget what he said. But he said something like, you know, like you don't waste your time on it. You know, like the earth's flat, blah blah blah. And he like sat there with a smug look on his face, and it was he did slowly become the butt of the joke the rest of the night. So that was pretty good. But I can't believe these type of people exist on this flat planet.
Do you really think he believed it, or is he one of those douchey guys who's like, "I'm going to be part of the act tonight"?
Well, that's what I don't know. Either he was like this young, early 20s, like, it's cool. Like, I got nothing, no other purpose in life, so I'm just going to believe something that is, like, controversial, and it's going to get people to, you know, it's going to cause... it's like trolling, you know what I mean? Like people on Facebook or something that just troll people for fun, like, and get reactions. I think that's what anybody who says they're a flat earth believer in 2000 and, oh my God, I almost said 2013.
From that point on is unacceptable. Now, 2012, totally cool.
Yeah.
I mean, we were all there, man. We were all there. We're like, yeah, it could happen, but, you know,
yeah.
Then 13 happened and we figured it out.
You ever do that? Just like as you're getting old, like not even realize what year it is sometimes. I go to sign something and write like 2 years before. I'm like, God, I am completely just lost. But yeah, anyone who's believing in that in 2018 is just looking for, I think, a rise out of people, a conversation starter, a agitator. Like if they figured that out in like you know, when Plato and Aristotle were around, I think someone's just like pulling your leg when they think the earth is flat. But I don't know. I want to get one of those guys on the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, you got to figure, okay, there's probably billions of pieces of evidence for round earth and maybe like 5 articles for flat earth. So God bless them for holding on to their ground and saying, nah, man. One other question I'd like to know, do they think the other planets are flat? Like, is Mars flat, or are we the only flat one?
That's a good point. Like, do they think we're just like a bunch of flat planets rotating around each other?
Yeah. Is the sun flat?
I heard someone or something like popped up. There's people out there that don't believe in other planets. That there's just
really,
yeah, like there's no other planets. Like they're just
so there's an infinite universe and one circle or flat bread.
Yeah, it's all fake. You know, like the planets are fake. So it's all a government conspiracy. Everything is not made up. We're flat. There's the edge of the earth. Some people say there's the edge of the earth that we're not the government covered. You get stopped if you get to the edge of the earth because they won't let you see the flat edge.
So where is the end per se? Is it like this country? Is it like Mongolia? Where we got to go?
If I had an educated guess, probably Delaware.
Oh, yeah. Well, that would make sense.
Because
if I lived in Delaware, I'd probably think the earth was flat all the time. Anyway.
I mean, driving through there, I wish there was. Sometimes I wish there was a cliff that I drive off, because driving through Delaware stinks.
Yeah, there's no clothing tax and there's no round earth. That's what we know here. That's all we know.
Every time I drive through Delaware, it's just, to me, it was always like gun shops and like Wawa's, like a lot of convenience stores and a lot of lights. No like major highway that lets you like scoot through Delaware. And like Delaware is this big, it should take you an hour to get through the whole state. Like there's no way, it shouldn't take any longer than that. And every time I go through Delaware, like when I went down to Dogfish or down to like Orioles game or something like that, it always seemed to be the sticking point of the trip, where it's like 45 mile per hour roads. Oh, there's another Wawa. There's a gun shop. There's no sports teams. There's nowhere to really visit. There's nothing for me in Delaware.
Yeah. Hey, is there a 7-Eleven around here? Get out of our Delaware.
In fact, they might as well just combine the gun shops and the convenience stores. Get a Slurpee and an AK.
Yeah, it seems like a fun afternoon, you know? Go visit a school.
Hmm? Yeah. But I don't know. I don't know how I got from Flat Earth to Delaware. But my point, if there was some edge they were protecting, what are they protecting people from? Just falling off? Like, or they just don't want them to know? Like,
yeah, I would just let them go.
Yeah, exactly.
You think I'm lying, huh?
Yep.
Go for it.
And
cross over to Maryland.
Not that, so you're telling me the government's spending all this money on just putting people on this edge, just standing there in case some dope finds the edge of the earth? Like, how many people...
Maybe that's why Trump's putting up the wall, to protect us from falling off the earth. There's no Mexico.
That's it. You know what? I always knew that guy had the right intentions, you know?
Yeah.
He's keeping us in. Yeah. He's basically building like a playpen.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He's worried that like the flat earth is going to kind of flip like maybe like a pizza box, and that's the corner that's going to keep us from falling off, you know?
That guy, he's, you know, he's my leader, my president.
Mhm. Yeah. Can we vote now?
Yeah.
I can't wait to 2020. Can I write it in?
Oh, he's going to be the first three-termer.
No, there's been a three-termer.
Oh, that's true. Well, he's going to be in the modern day. That he's going to be the first three-termer.
Teacher Scott Brennan.
He's going to be a five-termer. He's going to live forever.
He's going to be like Booker T. Five time, United States president.
I'm glad we've come full circle and we're back to wrestling again.
Yeah.
You got anything else?
That's pretty much it. Just my diamond head and flat earth. That's all you need to know.
Diamond heads, flat earths, and the islands of Hawaii.
Yep.
That pretty much sums up tonight. Well, Berlo, anything to promote?
Well, since we did enough wrestling, let's promote our friends at the Shining Wizards. Their podcast goes out. They do a live show every Tuesday. Good friends of ours, Kevin Garifo and all the gang. Rich McDonald's on there a lot of times. Check out their podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and anywhere you listen to great podcasts like this one.
Yes, yes. I'll promote our good friend Joe Fernandez released a funny sketch recently, so I'll actually promote a little sketch for you guys to go check out. Go check out, go look up Joe Fernandez. That's Fernandez with an S, not a Z. Fernandez with an S. Go check out a video on YouTube called Masterclass Italian Comedy. He did a great job of like a hacky Jersey Italian comic and what goes into it. Just do that. Well, maybe we'll share it on our page and whatnot. So go check that out. Berlo, you got one more week of the Walking Dead write ups, huh?
Yeah. This one's coming out this week. So yeah, I'm going to be doing the last one there. I've been getting a lot of responses. I've been very happy with the last. Few weeks have been getting a lot of responses from people and so forth. So that's on facebook.com/theburls.
What are you thinking about this season? What are your feelings before we go?
Better than last season, still needs to grow is the best answer. Kind of what we said texting back and forth. If I was them, I'd just blow it up. I'd just say, yep. kill off all of everybody that are saviors, kill off every third tier character that we don't care is a good person in living, get back to eight people, keep on running around, meeting up with weird psychotic people and figuring out a way of living.
Yeah, yeah. Something's got to give on that show. There's too many characters I don't care about. They die. I have no emotion. I'm like, okay. The bad guy doesn't kill anybody. I mean, he killed the guy last night, but he doesn't, like, he should be the one just murdering people. Like, be like, he's kind of like almost like a good guy. You know, like they're almost almost make him likable.
I think that's sometimes a problem with a lot of shows, that they're like, oh, we gotta get a background and truly show you why they're bad. I don't know. Sometimes they just gotta be a mean mofo that just murders anybody they don't like.
Yeah, and like I don't know. Eugene drives me crazy. Dwight, I don't really care about. Morgan, I feel like, is just completely lost. I don't really understand why he's crazy again. So he went from normal Morgan to crazy shot out Morgan. We lose him for a bunch of seasons. Comes back, he's crazy. Back to normal Morgan. Zen Morgan. Super Zen
Morgan.
Zen, peaceful Morgan. And now he's hearing voices, Morgan. Now he's seeing the dead. So, like,
seeing people. Yeah.
I don't buy that for a second. He's kind of just like a character that I don't think. Like, I think they know he's liked, but I don't think they have any idea what to do with him. But I guess he's going to be in the other show.
Well, they do know what they're going to do with him. Yeah. They're putting him on the other show.
Now, is he permanently going to the other show, or is he just appearing?
Yeah, he's permanently going over there. I mean, because basically Fear has, since the initial season, has not been getting the ratings. Like, I mean, regular Walking Dead's lost some ratings, but it was like a giant to, all right, good ratings. They went from good ratings to uh-oh. So this is their way of getting people interested, saying, hey, you know that character you know that you might like? He's over here now.
And someone told me it's not that bad. Like, it's actually gotten a lot better. Like, it's actually pretty good. But I haven't watched it since the first season. So I
haven't seen it in a while. I mean, for what I'm hearing of reviews, like, the first two episodes are supposed to be insane, but they say that about The Walking Dead every year, and then you're like, eh.
Yeah. So, at this point,
I mean, maybe I'll give it a shot, but
at this point, I'm totally just watching these things because I'm this far in. There's no other reason. If this show came out right now and the season was the way it is, the last three seasons, I wouldn't be watching. There's nothing. And like characters that I like disappeared for, like, I like that guy Aaron. Like, I think he's a pretty cool character. He's got some depth to him, and he finally, like, he was missing for like five episodes. Like, it's like we couldn't check in on him for 3 minutes per episode, like, and see what's going on. And like, I always try to think of what is the timeline here? Like is everything happening in one day? because
I don't know.
You know, like,
I mean
I don't know.
They had some no-name character like Heath, who, when Tara went to the, like, those women who live by the beach, if you recall. And
that's what I'm saying.
Like
the guy's Aaron. The guy Aaron is with now. The girl's Aaron is with.
He's in that area right now. But there was a guy who's with Tara, Heath, and she came back, and he's like, oh, where'd he go? And that was like a season and a half ago. And it was like, it just show his dead body. I mean, now it's to the point where it's like, if he shows up, I'd be like, why are you coming back?
And okay. So then there's Tara, right? There's that whole storyline, like, last week. Like, ooh, is she infected? They just completely don't bring that up at all this episode. Yeah. Like, let's just forget that.
Well, they did. Like, the first 5 minutes of the episode before, that she's like, I'm fine. And then they just ended it.
I know. This massive plan by the bad guy to infect everybody. He infects a bunch of people, but of course, none of the main characters might have gotten infected. You know. Yeah. See, I don't, that's where it drives me crazy. Is it's all these startups that things, and then they just nothing really happens. Yeah. I just feel like it's hanging out with The Walking Dead. That's what it should be called. Like, we're just here, you know. We're just
see all the characters sitting on a stoop and all, and somebody comes up. Oh, old man Negan's in the neighborhood. Uh-oh.
Yeah. Oh, we're gonna read Carl's letters for the ninth episode in a row. you know, like he's been dead for like five episodes, and they're still like, let's read Carl's letter. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. They're like, oh, they're pissed that we killed him off. Let's have him narrate it.
Other characters I don't care about. I don't care about the Hilltop Carol. Mayor guy, whatever his name is. Mm-hmm. He's such an over actor too. Like, I feel like he doesn't even fit in. Like, he's like he almost like a weird like theater actor. It seems like I don't know. He bothers me.
Maybe I should try out for them, and I'll just go up to Robert Kirkman. Don't mess with me.
That lady
just
who,
see if I get a role
that,
in the show.
That lady who came to collect the records. I get that maybe they want to introduce a small character for later, but we don't hear anything about them now for three episodes. Like, she just goes and gets some. That's it.
She'll come back around episode six of next year.
You'd be like, yeah, cool. It's been so. It's been so long that I don't care about them anymore. Like, that's the mm-hmm. other thing. It's like, well, I don't care. Then I loved the guys who were imprisoned, the saviors who were in prison, and they're literally just being kept in like a chicken wire fence, like what I keep Obi in the yard with. Like,
we can't possibly get out of this thing.
There's 40 of us and like one guy with I don't even know if there was any
guard.
There
was guard. Like a 10-year-old with a gun at one time.
Yeah. That show drives me crazy at this point. Like, and Negan never really did it for me. Like, he's an amazing actor, but however he was written in his storyline just doesn't work for me. It doesn't. I don't care. Because it's been on for so long. Maybe that's it. You know, like, maybe I'm just losing care because the story's not doing anything for me anymore.
When you have pretty much. If you go on like a Walking Dead Wikipedia and they say these are the characters that are alive, you could probably count about 45 of them. I mean, between the good and the bad people where they had an official name, and it's like, all right, how am I going to care for about 35 of them?
Right.
You know,
this is how bad it is, Mike. Like, I'll read your the thing you do, the Walking Dead review,
and the Walking Dead.
I'll see the names. And I have to, like, sometimes Google. I'm like, who's that character again? I forget who, because I don't care about, like, I can't mm-hmm. remember some of these characters and, like, their names. And, like, why do I care if the nurse gets shot in the head? Like, this nurse that was there for one episode, and she gets shot. Like, I don't care. And Daryl, like you said, Daryl does nothing.
Yeah. Carol.
Oh, she's the worst.
The most developed, interesting character. To like the dumbest side note, so it's do better, guys. I like the show.
Yeah,
I do my write ups because I like the show. But guys, come on now, it's been a little too long. I mean, when we ragged about It's Always Sunny, they came back the next year and they just killed it.
Yeah, yeah, and even like that, Always Sunny still had like four episodes in that season that were good. Like, you know. It wasn't the best season, but they have rare complete misses. They have like two misses mm-hmm. per season, I would say. You know,
mm-hmm.
I missed that show, man. I wanted to, I need Charlie Day in my life, but I don't know. Anyway, let's get out of here. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Walking Dead sucks. Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Keep the wind at your back. Goodbye.
Yeah. Unless you're on a flat earth, in which case, don't do that. You'll fall off.
Yes.